Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Earwolf announcement.
Starting this Saturday, March 31st, archives, episodes older than 6 months of this show, James Bonding, will be available exclusively to Stitcher Premium subscribers.
Yes, this means starting March 31st, if you want to hear older episodes of our show, all you have to do is subscribe to Stitcher Premium.
But we wanted to give you final warning so you can take any actions necessary to hear all the episodes before they go to Stitcher Premium. Like if you want to download them all before free, before then, who are we to stop you?
No one. We're no one stopping you.
We're here to tell you to do it, even.
Please, just do it, everybody. Subscribing to Stitcher Premium is a great way to directly support our show. Plus, you can get access to hundreds of exclusive series like Hollywood Handbook, The Pro Version, Comedy Bang Bang Tour Shows, Throwing Shade's Deeper Shade of Shade, and more.
Including the potential James Bond commentaries that we're supposed to do by the time this contract is up.
Yes, and we will be doing them.
That's right.
Hopefully pretty soon.
So, do whatever you need to do, whether it's downloading all of our episodes and filling up your hard drive, or just subscribing to Stitcher Premium for $4.99 a month, or just $34.99 for the entire year.
And it is very important that all of you out there, if you're going to do this, please use our promo code BOND at Stitcher.com/premium for a 1 month free trial.
That's Stitcher.com/premium and code BOND.
And for more information on all the shows affected by the large scale archiving, head over to earwolf.com.
The Great Culling.
Matt and Matt and Matt. James Bonding Podcast.
Myra Gorley.
This is James Bonding on a lovely overcast afternoon.
Yeah.
I'm Matt.
I'm also Matt.
And we're here with another M. A returning favorite, Maurice LaMarche.
M-M-M-L. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me back.
M-G-M-M-M-L.
We're finally making good on our promise to cover some of the non-canon Bond films, starting with the most infamous of them all.
Couldn't get much more non-canon.
I know.
Casino Royale.
But ironically, there were a couple of canons in this movie.
There were.
Yeah.
Actual literal canons.
Yeah.
And actors from the canon.
It's true.
It's the 1967 Casino Royale by no less than 4 directors.
And that's beginning to make more sense.
Oh yeah. Did you?
Here's what I did. Guess. I have so
Houston
ignored
took
this.
Took a slot.
I've ignored this movie for its entire existence.
Why do you think you've never watched it?
I just, I was just like annoyed by its existence. I was like, why?
It's
why does this
out
movie
there
exist?
Noodling you.
And I had never watched it until this morning.
Wow. Well, and Maurice, this is really how you came to us saying,
it's true.
I want to do this one when it comes up. So what's your history with this film?
My history was that, and it's funny, I actually this morning double checked. I don't know if I mentioned on the last podcast, I grew up with the Myers brothers.
Mm-hmm.
At least spent a little bit of time in grade school with Peter Myers, and Paul Myers was 2 years behind and was my brother Paul's best friend. And then little Mike was in like the second grade. So, but the three Myers brothers are pretty inseparable, and they lived one building away from where my dad lived. So we would hang out a lot, and we had a thing for Flint movies.
Mm-hmm.
And, but this movie especially was very up for us. And I checked with Peter and Paul, on Messenger, and we watched it together. We had watched it together. We don't know if Mike was there, but this The film was very, very big for them, and they must have watched it dozens of times because the influence of this movie is all over Austin Powers.
It's crazy how similar it is.
Yeah. But, I mean, Austin Powers becomes a spoof of a spoof.
Right.
You know, at this point. But we talked at length about that this was, for a lot of us, the real introduction to Bond. I had thought I'd seen it in theaters, but I remembered since I was last on, I saw a trailer for it. Because when I downloaded the film to watch it again, I saw the trailer. I went, that's what I saw. I didn't see the whole movie. I didn't watch the whole movie till that afternoon with the Myers boys and a bunch of other guys from our sixth grade class. And so my father had the Playboy that had the pictorial of this. And I remember getting particularly, you know, doing a double take at the picture of Woody Allen leering over Dahlia LaVey, strapped tastefully nude to the table in his
covered
lair,
only by metal
covered
bands.
Only by little band metal bands. And I remember this was when I cemented in my evil lair fetish, as well as my tasteful nude fetish. And the line that Woody has when she goes, "Is this how you treat?" When Dahlia LaVey says, "Is this how you treat all the women that you're attracted to?" He goes, "Yes, oh yes, I undress them and tie them up." I remember asking my father, "Dick, I learned that in the Boy Scouts." I remember saying to my dad, "Should I join the Boy Scouts, Dad? I'm the right age for the Boy Scouts, right?" I actually took them literally. But
you're probably better off. Look what happened to Woody Allen.
Oh, yes. Yeah. The joke of course, is that at that point, Dahlia LaVey was too old for him. He was acting. But we watched the movie, and there was so much comedy that I didn't get.
There's still some in there I don't
get. You
don't
get. I agree.
But there was some great jokes. The you know, especially about British society and about the decline of the British Empire.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was literally in its last gasp around 1967 or so. And there's so many things in the movie that are, you know, just like the end of Britishness. But I just loved like the bigness of it. And I remembered the next time it was on TV, because we watched it on something that was called the Sunday Afternoon at the Movies, I think it was called. And the next time it was on, I remembered audio taping. We didn't have videotape in those days.
I used to do that too.
The 1960s. So I would listen to the film because I became fascinated with the voices, especially the sound of Wells' voice and the sound of Woody Allen's voice, but also David Niven. And I got to the point where I could actually quote, you know, lines from the movie, like,
"I'm going to have that check, Mr. Bond. The most exquisite torture is all in the mind."
And I would just walk around the house doing things, which I guess this is why I ended up doing what I do for a living.
So is this the origin of your Wells impression?
It's the original origin. Now, of course, I was 10 at the time, 10 or 11, so I wouldn't have had the bass response in my voice to actually do the voice. So it would have been a falsetto Orson Welles. But I'd always been fascinated with the voices. When I was a kid, I used to watch cartoons, and I wanted to know who were those people.
Yeah.
Who, watching the Warner Brothers cartoon, I had no idea that it was one guy.
It's incredible.
For the most part. It was Mel Blanc and Arthur Q. Bryan as Elmer Fudd, and other than that, it was Mel Blanc. But the sounds were what fascinated me as much as Dahlia LaVey tied up to a lab table. But so I just really got into those voices.
Can we hear what little 10-year-old Maurice LaMarche would sound like walking around doing Orson Welles?
I got to heal him.
"Going to have that check, Mr. Bond. The most exquisite torture is all in the mind."
I don't know. It was crazy.
Oh, God.
But this film, I got to say, though, upon rewatching it, this is the first time I've watched it in a long time. It's a fucking mess, and I really feel... I feel bad I know you guys were going to do this film anyway, but I know I also wrote you and pushed and said, if you ever do Casino Royale, I want to come in.
We've been wanting to knock out another movie that wasn't in the canon for a while, and it just so happened that you were the ace up our sleeve of like, well, Maurice can actually come in and do this on very short notice.
Well, we have this great Goldilocks of the three versions of this, where Maurice, you grew up with it. I've seen it a few times, just like in my Bond interests, but I'm by no means like seen it as many times as the rest of the Bond films. And Matt, this is your first time.
First time.
So what was your initial reaction to this thing?
My initial reaction, I was delighted to see Mathis. when it starts, yeah. You're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then when they go to Sir James Bond's retirement estate, oh. I was delighted.
Oh, God. If I could lounge in Niven's lounging wear, oh, my God.
It starts out actually rather
very
well.
Promising. Yes,
and really I liked promising. The plot point of the idea that Bond was an original from World War II and then retired, and that because that was a conceit they wanted to use for Skyfall.
Yeah.
The castle or the ancestral home was a retirement home for the former James Bonds. They thought about that for 2 seconds.
It'd be crazy if they'd gone that full circle, no, along really with 007 being a code name, which is also the case for this movie, you know, that
right.
It's passed on.
Yeah.
But I thought that sort of showed some promise, the idea of
a celibate Bond. I was into the idea of what would a retired James Bond be like. And quite frankly, I feel like he'd be very much like that.
No kidding.
Niven is so good.
He drives the Bentley.
One of the original, if not the original choice
that's right.
Fleming had in mind
yeah.
for the character of Bond.
Yeah.
Even though he later wrote that he looked like Hoagy Carmichael.
Yeah, Hoagy Carmichael.
Scar on his cheek. Hoagy Carmichael was about 6'3", rather lanky fellow. But... you know, Niven would be who he wanted to play it. Niven was 57 when he did this picture.
Wow.
3 years younger than what I'm about to turn next week. I remember when I was a kid.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. I'll be by the time this airs, I'll have hit my 60th birthday.
Oh, my God. Everybody send it, Marisa.
Oh, my
happy
God.
Birthday.
I just let it out that I'm 60. It's over now. Ageism will kick
you. You look great. I was literally just thinking when you were talking about watching it in seeing the trailer in 1960, I was like, wait, how old is Maurice? This is crazy. And then I was like thinking, well, you know, he did all those voices, and I was like 12 when that was on. I was like, well, he must have been 22 when he did that. And I was like, well, hang on a second. That doesn't work either.
No, fat don't crack. Here I come.
Matt, get me a tamale.
You got it, buddy.
Matt has just served us these delicious tamales, by the way, to get our energy up.
Pasadena, South Pasadena.
He goes
Pasadena
to the Pasadena,
Farmers
the SoPass Farmers Market, and he picks up these tamales.
Handmade tamales. They're incredible.
Not today, but tamale.
It's hard to... Right.
I'm sorry I said that. I really am. Oh, my God.
Oldest Say that as Orson Welles, at least.
Not today, but tamale. I can't believe I said that. They're full of country goodness and green penis. I'm leaving.
That's amazing. I would buy those if I heard a radio commercial for that. Okay, so it starts very promisingly. I like the idea. I really enjoyed all of the various branch heads driving into that crossroads together.
Yeah, that's a really interesting opening shot.
Yes.
Yeah, and then they all get into one car.
Yeah.
And the sort of the bemused irritation of the one chauffeur who has to drive them.
Yeah. I was like, he drew the short straw.
What's the problem, pal? These are like, you've got Charles Boyer in your car.
I know. And just give me anything with William Holden.
Yes.
I will eat it up. God, I love that man. Yeah.
He's great. I love that it was both Charles Boyer and Kurt Kasner. I'm a bit of a theater freak. And Kurt Kasner had originated the part in Barefoot in the Park of the crazy guy who lives
upstairs. Oh, I didn't know that.
He originated it on Broadway, and Boyer played it in the film. And there they are standing together.
Oh,
yeah, I'm a theater freak, and I can't remember the name of that character. Such a great character.
I can't either.
George.
No. George of the Jungle. Sorry, I have that. If I hear a name or anything like that, I sort of semi-Tourette's song titles and things like that.
That's why you're great for podcasting. That's all podcasting is. That's right. Stream of conscience Tourette's.
Hands down, my favorite thing about this entire film by a country mile is Hadley. And that super British guy that helps Niven out.
Is
he the first one? Is he the very first one with the very perfect hair? And as soon as he walks in, this whole film is a British off.
Yeah,
it really is. I remember as I'm watching it going, My God, it's like they knew that, Matt and Matt
were, he's, you know, like a proto
the most British character. You can't pick the most British character in this film.
I know.
Well, there's so many
I
of
would
them.
Choose him,
is
though.
This the one that is pointing out the map?
Yes.
He wins.
He's incredible, isn't he?
He is, what is amazing. What is
that
guy
done? Although that general, when Maida Bond is in the, we're jumping around.
Yeah.
But when she's, you know, when at she's the at the art auction, he goes, "Hello, Brunilla. I'm not going to be home for dinner."
Seems the wall's what? Broken out.
There's sort of walls broken out. He's pretty friggin' British, too.
This Hadley guy, though, is kind of like a proto Mr. Bean.
That auction scene, yes. I found delightfully funny. Like, we will stand when we're bidding. We'll sit when we're bidding. And the British are like, "We'll do both."
Yeah. Oh, true. That was like one other moment that really worked for me.
That, by the way, that actor's name was Richard Wattis, the British Army officer.
Oh, Derek Nimmo is Hadley.
Oh my goodness.
What else was he in? Just only British movies.
And the army, the armory scene with their version of Q, and then the tailor, you know, who outfits him. Also extraordinarily British.
The tailor, I was like, in my mind, I was just like, oh, was this just hilarious to people then? Like the idea of an effeminate tailor?
It wasn't spoken of.
I know.
So, you know.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Peter Sellers peeking out going, "Hello, sailor."
Yeah.
And that was like risque comedy. Ooh, he's poking fun. At the homosexuals.
Peter Sellers was... he was great. I really enjoyed him, just screen presence-wise. Yes. I was like, oh, Peter Sellers is...
Well, his involvement in the picture, it's somewhat legendary that he really didn't want to be there and walked off before his scenes were done, which is why the film is such a friggin' mess.
Huh.
He left before they could really wrap up his character, and that's why they wrote in that Ursula Andress, for no reason at all, shoots him. It wasn't supposed to end that way. And he and Wells apparently couldn't stand each other.
That tracks.
There's really only one shot of the two of them in the same thing. And everything else is one shots. And they apparently filmed on different days for the rest of it. They just...
Two very big personalities. Yeah. Huge. Wow.
That is crazy. Wow. I'm fascinated to like read more about the making of this movie and
I would almost want to see a documentary about the making of this film. It would almost be as interesting as the Lazenby documentary.
Yeah, I agree. I would rather see that. What was the thinking of four directors? Just like, let's do this collaboration piece and that'll be part of the fun of it all? Or?
I have no idea. That part I'm not privy
to. I think all of the stuff with David Niven works.
Houston, I think the only way Houston would do it, and they wanted Houston, was he'd say, I have to be able to direct the sequence. You know, good spy is a pure spy. So, you know, it was great up until his wig flies off.
Yeah.
And then I went, oh,
we're in trouble.
Yes, until his wig flies off.
But I mean, I could see if I was watching the film for the first time as you were this morning, Matt Myra, that you might think, well, this isn't so bad. And then there's M signal and then shoo.
Were you clear on what was happening?
No.
Because it's not clear that they die or...
Well, it's,
well apparently
it becomes
Holden's
clear.
Character lives.
Yeah.
Ransom.
It becomes clear when he's delivering the toupee to M.
Yeah, I know it becomes clear then, but yeah.
Yeah, and also like I'm like, who's firing the mortar shell? I thought that here's what I thought was happening when I was watching it. I thought that when he lit the cigar, that's the signal to fire the mortar. And then I thought their whole plan was we need James Bond back. He's never going to leave his home. Well, then if he won't come back willingly, we'll destroy his home. So he has to come back. That was the plan, right?
That seemed like the plan. And yet he wasn't, I don't think M was planning to get killed.
And yet that was not the plan.
So the plan went a little bit askew. And yet there was Smirsch. I mean, what happened to M's actual widow? We assume she was eliminated. I don't know. But there's Deborah Kerr.
Yeah.
There as impersonating. And you'd think that David Niven Bond would have met Mrs. McDowdy at some point, but there she
unless
is.
She was there to be a double, you know, because there's so many doubles in the movie.
That's true. The doubling is a very big part of this film, but that to me is when it sort of starts to fall apart.
Like, I'm confused by the very, very beginning of the movie. with Mathis.
That threw me too, because it's like if you cut from that to about an hour 40 into the film,
then it makes sense.
It makes sense because the next thing that's the shot before Mathis and Peter Sellers Bond get into the car.
Yeah,
I don't even remember what is the Mathis thing in the beginning.
It goes James Bond. I was like, I'm with Mathis with the special police. Follow me.
What is that structure they're in with the graffiti, all that circular...
The graffiti that says Les Beatles?
Yeah, Les Beatles and all that. It's a circular aluminum band around a pillar. Is that like a public men's room or what the hell is that?
I've
never seen anything like that.
It's the first shot of the movie, right?
It's the very first shot. The film starts after the MGM lion. Mathis is there. Mr. Bond...
I was getting excited. I was like, "Oh, are they gonna? Is this literally a retelling of Casino Royale that has some humor in it?"
Yeah,
but it is not.
Originally going to be that, and then what was the reason? There was a reason that it changed, and I forget what it is.
Charles K. Feldman only does comedies. Might have been part of the reason. I'm not sure. I mean, he brought Woody Allen on board.
That the other thing I laughed at or found funny, I didn't actually laugh out loud, I was like, oh, that's cute, was him escaping the firing squad and then jumping the wall.
That's a good gag. Other side of the that's firing a really squad. Good gag.
Pure Woody Allen.
That's
he wrote everything he was in. That was part of his deal. He had to write all of his own scenes.
Yeah.
That I've picked up on the internet over the years. Okay, over the last year, because I've only had the internet for a year, because I'm old. No. But yeah, that's something that's why all of his stuff works, because he had almost an auteur-like
presence. But there. It's so hard to describe the... Okay, so there's someone. Is there so?
It's not it, even. Is it, are you trying to figure out the plot?
No. Oh. It's for the director situation. Someone's directing the David Niven stuff, right? Someone's directing the Peter Sellers stuff, right? Someone's directing the Woody Allen stuff. What's the fourth thing?
I don't know.
Weird psychedelic stuff that they're all involved in, those hideouts and that thing that takes place in East Berlin with Mata Bond.
I liked that.
That was a huge production number, and it did have a great look to it, but I felt it kind of stopped the film for a little bit.
Yeah.
And the film's got some very incesty, rapey...
The bathtub scene where Ruby, by the way, Ruby from Honor Majesty's Secret Service, Angela Sklar, is in the bathtub waiting for David Niven saying, I used to do this to my daddy. But not even like when I was a kid.
But listen.
That's the same actress who plays Ruby.
Yes, 11, they're adopted.
See, I was congratulating myself because the art auctioneer was the same as...
From Russia with Love.
Yeah. What's his
name?
Oh,
yeah. Vladek
Shibol. The chess champion.
Like, I got two of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ursula Andress and Vladek.
Yeah.
But no, that's Ruby. That's amazing.
Vladek Shibol, I think is his name.
Yeah. I love the sort of... the way he just comes out blasting away, but still somewhat elegant.
Yeah,
still
he's a great character face.
Cop
yeah.
walks right up to him and he's like,
My favorite visual gag in the movie is the Jeep driving from West Berlin to East Berlin, and it turned red. Like they had just swapped the Jeep out when it went behind the wall, and they just drove out the red Jeep. That was very funny.
That's funny. I didn't even notice that. I think this more than any, I really did tune out the longer it went on. I was just kind of like, it plods. And
well, having never seen it, I was like, I can't, like, during a normal James Bond viewing for this podcast, I will often scrub through sweeping establishing shots, which will save you about 25 minutes per James Bond movie, honestly. But this one I was like, well, I don't know where these scrubbing, I don't know where to do it. So I have to sit here and enjoy to the best of my ability. Enjoy this movie.
I should love this movie because it's in my favorite era, probably, of filmmaking.
Yeah.
It's got design. It's a period piece. It's that kind of fun, freewheeling, strange movie. And I think they have an attempt at some actual absurdist humor, but it just misfires almost every time. And I'm surprised I don't actually like this movie, but that's really saying something about
what do you think of the TJ Brass?
No, I don't love it. I normally like the
Tijuana Herb Albert dress. Situation, yeah. But
it doesn't fit dress. Bond for me. I don't know.
But that, yeah, that to me, I preface this by telling you I'm the world's biggest Burt Bacharach enthusiast. I was, as a kid, I worshipped him. I don't know whether it was because my parents split up and I just kind of...
You also thought what the world needed was
Bacharach,
love?
Bacharach and my father kind of resembled each other. But,
yeah? Wow.
Yeah, they both had that same hair, that really choppy...
Still alive, Burt Bacharach.
Burt is still doing great. I saw his last concert here in town.
Wow.
And in fact, to go back to the Myers Brothers, I mean, I love them all and love them as kids. And Mike's success... I was never jealous of Mike's success, but I was jealous of the fact that he got to work with Burt Bacharach.
Yeah,
that he
and Elvis Costello.
Because I was kind of known in my class as being a bit of an oddball because I liked Burt Bacharach,
uh-huh.
and everybody else was into the Beatles. Uh-huh. And I used to walk around with like a little boombox, listening to Bacharach songs because I'm a weirdo. And the fact that Mike got to cast Burt in his movie, and I was like, oh God, I've always wanted to meet, and I've never met Burt Bacharach, and I probably never will. That's the only shred of jealousy I have toward Mike Myers, you know, and Bert's music for this, and I call him Bert because I've never met him. it's exactly the wrong kind of music for a James Bond film, but it works for this film.
Yeah, I guess
in its absurdity because it's so fucking cheerful. Here's this cheerful theme as Mata Bond is being kidnapped. And dun, 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 ba, ba, ba. You know, it's like it's so derails you and takes you somewhere else.
Yeah, you know, it's almost like I don't mind the melody. The Bacharach stuff as written is pretty good. I think it is the Tijuana Brass that somehow just don't drive it home for me or something.
Yeah, there's a lot of sort of wah wah going on with that stuff. Especially the chase music. However, I'll put Look of Love up against any Bond love theme.
That's a good
including, you know, All the Time in the World. It's great song. Wow. And I can't believe it lost the Oscar to Chitty Chitty Bang Bang that year.
Wow, because they had to give something to the Fleming.
To the Fleming.
Fleming was like, we're sorry about this.
Right.
Here's a Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Right.
I'm just trying to figure out this script by reading a little bit about it right now.
You mean the problems behind it or what that?
Yeah, the problems behind it.
Yeah. Well, one of the problems in front of it is Ching Ling when she says every fifth child born in the world is Chinese and she's not even Chinese.
No, isn't that weird? That was so bizarre.
There was another really funny moment that I love when that guy gives himself a karate chop to the head and his comic take on that. They've got some real like journeyman comedian.
Yes, I mean Ronnie Corbett's in the movie as that little
Mata Hari's little
Solo. No, was it No, I can't remember the name of the little guy as you. Mata. Yeah.
Five different directors.
Yeah. Oh, you're right.
Oh wow.
Helming different segments, and stunt coordinator Richard Talmadge co-directed the final sequence. In addition to the credited writers, Woody Allen, Peter Sellers, Val Guest, Ben Hetch, Joseph Heller, Terry Southern, and Billy Wilder are all believed to have contributed.
Joseph Heller of Catch 22?
Mm-hmm.
Billy Wilder, wow. This thing should be better.
Not really.
Val Guest was given the responsibility of splicing various chapters together and was offered a unique coordinating director, but declined, claiming the chaotic plot would not reflect well on him if he were credited.
Fair. That was back when people used to have, you know, pride in their name.
His extra credit was labeled additional sequences instead. This is amazing.
It's funny, too, that ending, how much Blazing Saddles draws on that ending, and I didn't realize that before, too.
Right.
Yeah, that is
the
just...
the sheer chaos.
Almost purely lifted from that.
I loved the ridiculousness of the Americans arriving, but it's just cowboys.
Yeah, and then Indians.
It's insane. It is this movie makes no sense. This movie is like less cohesive and coherent than Magical Mystery Tour.
Yeah. Or Octopussy.
By a lot.
Octopussy, as we all have established here, is beautifully clear.
Jeez.
There's just some jewel smuggling and a nuclear bomb. What more could you want? This one has a nuclear bomb pill.
That's right. And animated atomic burp clouds.
Yeah, those are tiny mushroom clouds that Woody Allen burps up. This is crazy.
Can I make a huge stretch here? I mean, Woody Allen, we know from his films. What? What did you just do? Yeah. It's got to be better than what I was about to say.
Maybe this is the funniest sentence I've ever read in my life.
What?
Where to go? Okay. Hang on. I'm sorry. I just lost it. Okay. Wells also insisted on performing magic tricks as Le Chiffre, and the director obliged.
Of course, because he had already gotten into his big magic phase, and he was on I Love Lucy doing magic.
I don't know anything about Orson Welles' magic
phase.
He has
a whole documentary called After
What?
It was his next love in life after filmmaking, because nobody would let him make films. Nobody would give him money. But he became quite the magician. I remember, though... I watched this live on TV back in the days that Tonight Show was live. Wells guest hosted once, and he did a very long and protracted mentalist trick with members of the audience. It was supposed to be this, ladies and gentlemen, I want you all to picture a card. I mean, it's like, you know, the 300 people in the studio audience were supposed to all imagine a card. He was going to make sure that they all said the same card or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, The trick went horribly wrong. It didn't pay off at all. There was literally no applause, and he just kind of arched an eyebrow and went, "Oh, that didn't quite go the way we wanted it to, but we'll be back after these words." The aplomb with which he handled it, even though, you know, the flop sweat was running down his face.
Oh, my God.
But it was like he treated it almost as though it was the audience's fault, everybody else's fault for not paying off this mentalist thing that he was supposed to do.
This is like, this is genuinely, I was delighted when this was happening in the film. When you show Orson Welles and he does a levitation trick on the card table.
Yeah, and however,
but it's
all
not
of,
even a real trick.
No,
I mean,
it's all camera stuff.
No,
yeah.
Of course. So
that's the
course,
best part.
But it just, the thought of Le Chiffre, the thought of like real Le Chiffre.
Yeah.
Also being into magic,
like imagine
at the poker table,
like 2006 like, Casino
yes,
Royale.
Yes, yeah, just say Mads Mikkelsen. You know,
yes, this thought, like,
excuse me, while I
just tickled me.
Oh my God,
to no end. Like he had an affinity. Like if he
Pick
asked Vesper to please lay on the table and then levitated her and then made her disappear. Just
you shoot, Mr. Bond, pick a card.
Mr. Bond. Mr. Bond, I'm going to make your balls disappear.
There's also the element of that, too. Like, the chair has no upholstery. Like, that's sort of like Casino Royale.
Yeah, but that's a scene in the book.
Yes,
too.
I know, but
and
like...
so they made reference to it without showing the actual,
yeah,
you know,
but like,
testicular.
Was that torture? Like a
little
nudge-nudge to the audience who had read Casino Royale?
I think so. I remember thinking that. That torture scene, though, was a complete hodgepodge of WTF. I mean, where was that supposed to go? How did he get hold of him? I mean, at one point, he's jumping into a race car where he magically has on a race suit. One second, he's wearing a tuxedo.
Not as fast as me in my Lotus 3.
In my Lotus Formula 3.
It's probably because it was a director switch.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean,
or he had walked off, but they didn't finish the car chase.
Who knows?
It's.
Do you think this is the biggest disparity between two films with the same name, like in history of all of film, like of all reboots?
I don't know. I like the original 1946 Happy Death Day. No, I think you're right. This has to be right. I mean, it's crazy.
It has to be. I can't think of. I mean, I know there are some movies
Heaven
that they.
Kevin Kuwait and a guy named Joe. Was apart from changing it from boxing to football.
Well,
Far and Away.
Yeah.
Mr. There goes Mr. Jordan. That was the name. There goes.
But
Mr.
we
Jordan.
Just we're just talking about same title.
Yeah.
Like movies with the same title in the catalog.
Or even,
oh,
but
I got
even
one
that
for
type
you.
Of thing. Yeah, like
Ghostbusters
Always and a guy named Joe.
Good point.
No, but that's still the. It's both
they're
of
still
our
comedies.
Comedies and they're.
Oh, yeah,
still
that disparity
ghosts.
Is not.
This is like. This is the film that, you know. You read the book and you. And I read the book as a kid. In fact, I read it before. I think after I saw the Playboy pictorial and the preview, I actually read the book in sixth grade. And that's, and
you must have been
like heavy reading for
fascinating time.
Was this before or after seeing the movie?
I think I hadn't seen the movie yet.
Wow.
Because
must not have been what you thought.
I remember when I watched the movie going, apart from the card game, this is nothing like the book. The only thing I remember about the book was, of course, her dying and learning in the sixth grade the rules of Baccarat.
Yeah.
I kept practicing them with a card because I went, this is a really confusing game, but I'm going to get this game down, you know. I'm going to get my Orson Welles impression down and this fucking game.
You've explained it to us, and I understood it as good as I've ever understood it, and then completely forgot it, and then started watching this again, and I was like, wait, what's that mean?
It's easy to forget. Batman, the original Batman movie, Adam West one, and the Christopher Nolan ones, probably close, but those are both successful.
You had the stopover in the Tim Burton world, which sort of bridges those two.
Those are the same name. One's Batman.
It doesn't
begins.
Have to be the same name.
Well,
it's the same
I
idea.
Thought this was the game.
No, not that technically.
Because then you got, you know, because then it would qualify the Michael Keaton one and the Adam West one.
Yeah, but those I are don't sort think of those similar,
though. By comparison, though, those two pictures are a lot closer than they seemed at the time in 1989.
I know. Remember,
you went, "Oh, this is so dark."
Yeah. Now but it's so campy.
Add the Nolan dimension to it.
Yeah.
And 89 Batman is.
I can't wait for the 2029 Batman.
Right.
Which is just going to be a depressing.
Could be Batman Beyond, when Bruce has aged himself out of the suit and he has a young protege who's in the suit now. Mm. It's a great cartoon. Check it out.
Okay. Big Batman Beyond fan over here.
Audiobooks are great for helping you be a better you, whether you want to feel healthier, get motivated, or learn something new. And with an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more, Audible has all the audio content you need to start your year on the right foot. For instance, did you know the Fleming James Bond novels are on Audible, including Casino Royale? Read by Dan Stevens, many people think might be a contender for the next James Bond. Live and Let Die, read by Tanner from the new Daniel Craig films, Rory Kinnear. From Russia with Love, read by Toby Stevens, the bad guy from Die Another Day. Moonraker, read by Bill Nighy, the creepy guy from Love Actually. Diamonds Are Forever, read by another Bond contender, Damian Lewis. Octopussy and The Living Daylights and Other Stories, read by another contender, Tom Hiddleston. So whether it's on your phone, through a car, from a tablet, or at home on an Amazon Echo, you can read tons of books while doing almost anything. And Audible even lets you switch seamlessly between devices, picking up exactly where you left off. Start a 30-day trial and your first audiobook is free. Go to audible.com/bond or text bond to 500-500. That's audible.com/bond or text bond to 500-500 for a 30-day trial and free first audiobook.
All of that. Listen, the Batman animated series is the best that Batman's ever been. That's beside the point. The point here is Casino Royale and a magician, Lashif, who, I also enjoyed his champagne trick where the cork balloon pops off and then you're like, wait, what just happened? I also enjoyed the fact that Orson Welles refused to remove the tablecloth thing that he put over the lady. It was always on his lap throughout the entire movie. When they went to his torture room, he had it on his lap.
That's like FDR, but instead of polio, it was just heaviness.
But like, it's like just in case. No, I think it was just in case he wanted to levitate someone. Like, he's always ready to do it.
Place your hand, madam, and continue ascending into thin air. There's one line in there, though, that I'm sure Paul Frees came in and looped because they couldn't get Orson back, where he goes, torture of the mind, Mr. Bond. And then you hear, the most exquisite torture is all in the mind. And I was like, that's Paul Frees, because that's halfway to Toucan Sam. I mean, I feel like he looped that. I don't know.
When you were doing Orson Welles at 10 years old, and then you finally hit puberty, were you just like day by day going, I'm that much closer to Orson Welles?
Actually, I kind of dropped it. I didn't really pick up the Welles impression again until like New Year's of 84. Phil Proctor from the Firesign Theater gave me a tape of the famous Frozen Peas outtake.
Oh, yeah.
And we worked on a job till like almost 9 o'clock on New Year's Eve. It's like it was too late to go do anything. So he said, here, this will cheer you up, because I'd missed my flight. I was supposed to go to New York that morning, but I took this job that took forever. Anyway, so that tape fascinated me. And hearing Wells in the act of, as they used to say on Candy Camera, the act of being himself, I became fascinated with it. First I thought, my God, he's so intimidated. I would be scared shitless of this guy if I was in the room. And he's so rude and so off. And then as I'm listening to it over and over again, I realize he's right and those two British directors are totally wrong. You don't tell Orson Welles how to read copy. You know, but I just, lines like, get me a jury and show me how you can say, in July and I'll go down on you. It's just idiotic. Give me for my saying, so that's just stupid. In July. I'd love to know how you emphasize in July. Impossible. Meaningless. I memorized it the way you memorize a song. Like I just started paying attention to every little beat, even where he, you know, had stammers or his breathing where he ran out of breath. In the middle of a sentence, it still sounded right if he did it, you know, because you just, that was the beauty of Welles. You got his Orson Welles-ness, no matter what you hired him for. There's a story within the animation world of a director starting to direct him as he's doing, actually, was his last job.
Transformers.
And God rest his soul, Wally Burr started to give Orson like a little bit of a direction of his character, and he stopped. He said, Wally, stop. Faster, slower, louder, softer. That's the only direction I take. And that was it. Wow. That was it. They got along famously from that point on, because that's all, or you know, Wally got it, and that's all the only direction he gave him. So yeah, for me, the Welles thing, I developed it later on in life, but it remained a fascinating voice to me, and still does. I still think there's ways I can improve it.
It's funny at this point he has aged into old Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like the makeup and the huskiness of
the
it
cane,
all.
The cane that he predicted, though, was slimmer. I don't think he having an eating disorder.
A bit. I was, the whole film, I'm just fascinated by the fact that people paid money to see this.
I'm not, because look at the star power. It's James Bond. They probably, getting him in wasn't an issue, but keeping him in must have been a problem.
Because I think they knew that I think the news that Connery had, that You Only Live Twice was going to be his last picture. It came out the same year, didn't it?
Yeah, it did.
And I think the news that this is it, we've lost Connery, so here's your next taste of James Bond.
Right.
Yeah.
This is the future of James Bond. May have driven people to the theaters. I'm not sure. That's just a little theory that I have.
You know, it's interesting.
And everything was about Maud
in
those days. And spoofs were very, very in vogue. What's New Pussycat? Pictures like that. The Flint movies were very hot. Although the Flint movies were, I think they were more like little arches of the eyebrow, homages, but they weren't quite as spoofy as this, because
less parody and more satire.
Yeah.
Yeah. Coburn was so committed.
Yeah.
Coburn was so committed to playing.
Oh, yeah.
There was no archness to it. He played Derek Flint and he meant it. And even though it was a lighter character, I thought it was a really great portrayal.
We should do it, Mike Flynn, our man Flint.
Yeah.
We should.
Well, we're finally getting started with these movies. So
yeah.
Maybe we
will. The whole idea, though, that this movie had even exists is so fascinating to me.
Yeah.
It's like, I can't think of what's the film franchise now that is like, I guess it's sort of like,
well, it'd be like if there was a weird,
if it'd be like
shitty Harry Potter movie,
or if someone had purchased in 1980, the exclusive rights to one issue of the Avengers.
Yeah, right. And could do something.
And could put out a movie that had more star power than the Avengers Age of Ultron, and could use every character in that film, and did it, but then was like, you know what? It's a comedy. We're going to put... Let's have five different directors do this.
Right.
It's a strange subgenre.
But it was like, but they went in and got stars, but they got stars that were like, so in this Avengers movie, it would be like, Tom Hanks and Jack Nicholson. It would be like stars where you're like, okay.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise as Agent Colbert. Like, it's just a
subgenre I'm curious to look at, because I think you could also take like the Roger Corman Fantastic Four that they kind of made just to keep the rights.
I have that movie at home.
And then like just these movies that exist outside of franchises that are of that franchise that, yeah. You know what I mean? I'm so curious that before the Casino Royale that you and I love so much to exist, this thing had to exist and it had to kill all Casino Royale for what? 30 years.
Yeah.
For the movie that became our favorite Bond film to exist. So
40 years.
Jesus. Right. So our favorite Bond film doesn't exist without this probably the worst Bond film.
Do you?
And yet that Bond film, and by the way, it's right up there for me too, the 2006 Casino Royale, Casino Royale.
Casino Royale.
Yes. Now Ian.
Oh.
Weren't we just sharing a nice cognac up in the afterlife?
Yes, I was having a bath and a brass tureen filled with cranberry vodka.
You're both on the James Bonding podcast right now. Thank you guys for being here.
Oh.
It's always a delight to travel from the celestial.
I flew in and chitty chitty bang bang.
Oh, well, you know, Ian, we're just discussing a film that Orson was in.
I was lowered in
Transformers. I love that film.
No, it's not Transformers. It's actually Casino Royale.
Oh, I thought it was Frozen Peas, the movie.
I love that one as well. Mm. I also loved you in Paul Masson. What? Yes.
Paul Masson Strikes Back?
When you wrote the character of the chief.
The French. Champagne has long been celebrated for its excellence. There is a California champagne inspired by that same French excellence. And like the best champagne, it's vintage dated and fermented in the cut.
Action,
I'd like
please.
To now do a magic trick for you all. She'll make this bottle of Booker's disappear.
I can do that as well. I do most days, as well as 70 Chesterfield Turkish cigarettes.
Chesterfields are delicious.
I eat them. These days, you know, I cut to the chase and just salt and eat. Right in.
Mr. Fleming, are you happy with the way Casino Royale turned out?
Which one there, dear boy?
The one from 19. The one that Orson Welles did.
Heavens, yes. That's what I was trying to get at with the novel, but I fell short. When I finally saw the film, I was just in love with it. And then, of course, they smeared it and tarnished it in 2006.
But you were happy with my participation, were you not, Ian?
Dear boy, I couldn't have been happier. I should have had you out to Golden Eyes sometime out in Jamaica, and we could have put some cocoa butter on you and sizzled you up in the Jamaican sun.
That would have been lovely. I've never been sizzles in Jamaicas.
You simply haven't lived.
Is that anywhere near Acme Acres by chance?
Absolutely.
Sorry,
Mr. Welles, did you read Casino Royale before you took the part?
No.
Why would he?
No, I would. I don't read such tripe.
I didn't read it before I wrote it.
That's true. That's very true.
I read philosophy and cookbooks. Yes.
What's your favorite thing to cook, Mr. Welles?
My favorite thing, of course, is to cook rosebud frozen peas, full of country goodness and green penis. Oh wait, I used that joke already in this podcast. With apologies to the folks who made the critic.
I don't know if you've ever had frozen peas, Mr. Fleming, but they're out
you
of
know,
this
world. I don't often have frozen food. I like eggs scrambled with green figs and yogurt.
I find if you put the frozen peas under your tongue and then imbibe some good French cognac and light with a Cuban cigar, cooks them up deliciously.
That actually kind
I'm having
of
trouble breathing
great.
Now.
Oh, Mr.
It's
Welles.
Odd because I'm non-corporeal, but I still wheeze in the next life.
So you're not living, but also having trouble staying alive.
Yes, apparently I damaged myself that badly in the life.
I sort of get it.
In the afterlife, I'm having trouble breathing and keeping my cholesterol down.
I've smoked so much that my lungs have become sort of like a volcanic rock, you know, very porous. So I can't keep anything in, including air. And when I drink, you know, in those films when someone's shot and they do a comic take where all the water spills out of them? Mm-hmm. It's like that with air. So there's a slight wheeze as I walk and I act as a sort of biological bellows that pushes the air out as I go. Listen.
Like a pumice stone.
Yes, I suppose. Or a loofah.
I am just so sad that Matt Gourley, my co-host.
Who's that now?
He's the co-host. We do this podcast together. You've never met him.
I don't much like him.
He's often out of the room when you're here.
Well, that's why I don't like him. Seems to have an aversion to me. It's probably a lesbian.
Well, thanks so much for coming down, Mr. Fleming.
Absolutely. I'm going to take my little library ladder back to heaven. You know,
wait,
the kind.
I thought you arrived in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
I did, but it broke down as it's wont to do, so I'm going to climb my little oaken library ladder that rolls along on wheels in my library. Bye now.
When you get up there, get 17 or 18 people to pull up on the chain, would you? I need to ascend as well.
I will.
Thank you, Anne.
I know a whole squad of butch gals up there that barely speak to me because they know. What?
A squad of butch gals.
Squad of butch gals.
Like a Pussy Galore's Flying Circus.
You know, I was wrong about it down here, and up there I've really come to like those women.
Well, they're beautiful, and they're just as good as everybody else, Mr.
Rugby
Fleming.
Rugby players to the end. I've got to go. I've said too much.
So long, Mr. Fleming.
Bye now.
Matt, you're out of toilet paper in the bathroom, by the way.
Wait. Now, guys, you're both not going to believe this. You're not going to believe this. But Ian Fleming and Orson Welles were actually here.
The two dead men?
They believe it or
long
not,
long since dead.
Yes, they appeared. Orson was lowered with chains, and Ian arrived on Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and left. Orson had 17 people pull him back up. As soon as you guys left the room, they appeared.
Matt, I'm truly worried about you.
No, this is it's all on tape. Have you ever gone back and listened to those sections of the podcast?
No.
Well, I assure
I'm
you,
very busy.
No, yeah. Maurice, they're there, and if you've heard me talk to Ian Fleming, right?
Yeah.
Well, it happened again while you were out of the room.
All right, let's just get on with it.
That was more cohesion than
the actual
movie.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
That's true. I mean, I assume that was true. I was.
Why does Sir James Bond have a stutter?
And then loses it.
He has a stammer that he has in his real life, but when he's on the job as James Bond, he doesn't have it. He also...
Like how Sherlock Holmes doesn't need cocaine when he's on a case.
Right, yeah. But they are kind of implying that Bond is celibate, like, by his natural state and doesn't really drink and stammers.
Yes.
But when he's on the job, that's not the case. But
he does try to steal a look at Ursula Andress's breasts when chatting on the precursor to the Apple Watch.
But they also, the way he kisses Moneypenny and finds out it's his daughter, implies that he and Moneypenny in this case might really have actually had something going on.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or they, in this world, that's how they always greeted each other.
Maybe. Yeah.
Listen, this movie's a mess.
It's a fucking mess.
Yeah.
Can we say fucking?
Yeah, we sure can.
Okay.
I enjoyed some, I would say probably a total of 7 of the minutes that I watched. I enjoyed.
Yeah, maybe 7.
Yeah.
How long is the big fight scene in Casino Royale?
The big fight scene in the real Casino Royale?
In 67.
Probably. You're talking about
six of the 7 minutes.
The last 18 minutes of the movie?
Right.
Is that what you're talking about?
Cowboys,
the Blazing
Indians,
Saddles. Yeah.
George Raft, you know, shooting
his
himself
weird
with
cameo.
A gun.
He must have just been there that day, right?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I
mean, and Peter Sellers is in the Peter O'Toole.
Peter O'Toole,
yes, right.
As a Scottish Highlander who gets asked if he's Richard Burton. Ask Peter Sellers if he's Richard Burton. He goes, no, I'm Peter O'Toole. Peter O'Toole's standing right in front of me. He goes, no, I'm Peter O'Toole. Then you're the finest man who's ever breathed. I love that. I mean, those little moments make the film worth watching for me. Those little comic asides. And again, the idea that the whole film is this British off. You know, there's so much in there that I do smile at, even as they try to paste it together to make it make sense, which it can't. And yet the way the film ends, we're further in. You think so?
I think
not without Peter Sellers.
If I had a little bit of time, I could recut this movie to make some sense. Like, and actually do chapters.
I think it's worth watching, even though it's a bit of a slog to get through. because it's strange to see all of these ingredients that you recognize served up in a meal like this, you know, and it's worth it for that reason. But for me, it's like a once every 15 years type of movie.
Right.
Which I wouldn't say that about any of the other Bond movies. I could watch them probably once a year at their worst.
Yeah. Know? Yeah, I will never see this movie again.
You think?
I think so.
What about when we do the commentary?
No, then I'll see it again.
Okay.
I mean, there's that.
No, we can't do commentary for that.
Yeah, we sure can. We can do whatever we want.
I know, but
we still have to do Star Warsing.
That's true. So let's rate this film.
Yeah, on a scale of what? Is this, we're going to use the 00 scale?
We might as well stick to our scale. Okay. I mean, they do use 007 codename in this.
They sure do.
Everybody's 007.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seven 007s.
Well, you know, for me, it's interesting. This movie gets a 002. Well, wait.
High praise indeed.
Is 000 the lowest it could be?
Yeah.
It gets a 001. Because there are some interesting
things
that are worth seeing once.
I'm going to have to agree. I'm going to say 001. And I'm looking to Maurice to bring the average up there because I understand ranking something high as a
nostalgic
favorite
situation, yeah.
And I will rank it higher than 001, but the fondness with which I remember it. I mean, the film, and I said this the last time, the film is of a time. You know, It's the 60s. It's a time I lived through. Did I mention I'm going to be 60 next week? And so for me, it does hold a nostalgic value, and I do remember films looking, you know, similar to this at the time. I didn't know how good they could be. I was going to just mention really quickly that, you know, you were talking about how dissimilar it is from the 2006 Casino Royale. What about the Barry Nelson version?
Yeah,
the TV
we haven't
version,
even talked about
which
that.
Is really close to, or will you cover that in another
episode? I think
episode?
We will probably
okay,
do
so I'll leave that alone.
How long, that, how long is that? What's
it's
the right
it's under an hour.
Yeah, right.
Under an hour, because it had to fit in with commercials into the season.
That's really probably the closest of any Casino Royale to the novel.
It follows the novel, and 2006 Casino Royale follows it, but I'll leave that alone for the next time you cover it. The mess that this film is, the thing that the one thing I wanted to hit on, though, touch on, was that, and speaking of hitting on so much inappropriate sexual groping in this film, I mean, when the girl falls backwards for the levitation trick, one of the two guys that catches her clearly gropes her breast.
Jeez, I didn't
before she's put on the levitation. He clearly has his hand on her breast as she goes back, and then
Orson begins his levitation. Get your hand off that woman's breast, sir.
But the fact that at the end of the film, and I'm spoiler alert for all of you who I know are rushing to it, the fact that everybody dies.
Yeah.
To me, this makes a great existential comment on the whole of life, because everybody in the film is a hero, and yet at the end, everybody you liked, everybody you cared about, everybody who, you know, you laughed at, everybody whose mission you wanted to succeed such that you could figure it out, is blown up. And it's like, well, that's life. In its own way, it's a brilliant film for saying that, for just showing me that no matter what the fuck I do, at the end,
I'm going to be playing a harp with Woody Allen.
I hope, because I got a lot of questions for him in between strums. So I'll give it a 002.
Wow, that's even lower than I thought, maybe. I thought, okay, but that's fair and judicious.
Know, because we're comparing it to Bond films.
Yeah.
As a 60s spoofy kind of, you know, when's Red Skelton going to walk into this? You know, I might give it a 004.
Right.
Or just because it's the type of film I remember.
Yeah.
But as a Bond film, yeah, 002, maybe, but 001.5.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It's not a Bond film.
Yeah, that's true. Well, speaking of Bond films, I wanted to just touch on Spectre for a second because Sean McCabe over at timetobond.com, which is a great website. In fact, he just did an article
It's Time to Bond.
That's right.
I follow him on the Twitter.
Yeah, me too.
I do.
He just did an article on all the other 00s in the movies, which is great. He kind of like sets them up and tells you exactly.
Oh, very cool.
Interesting. I wonder where he would get such an idea.
Did we do it?
We talked about
did
that.
Did we ever
Well, we've talked about it.
No, but I feel like we talked about it like about a month ago, the curiousness of, like, I would love to see a list of all the 00s that have appeared in the movies.
Well, good for him for doing it.
Does he touch on whether or not they ever have another 004?
Huh?
Did they touch on whether or not the number gets recycled once an agent dies?
There are, because 009 is used twice. Right. 00, I think, might be four. I can't remember. 009 is the Octopussy Bond and
Frank Sinatra Bond.
Ooh. What?
The Spectre, 009.
Yes, that's right. And it's actually 002. He's the Living Daylights one, I think, and something else. I forget. But anyway, he was nice enough to send me some of the pages from the Logan draft of the Spectre script. And it has the scene where Bond gets tortured with the drill to the head was originally a Texas Hold'em scene where Oberhauser says, if I win, you both die. If you win, I'll let the girl go.
Oh, thank God that changed. Somehow I'm pleased.
Yeah,
with
it doesn't quite work. But the thing that's interesting is, you know how when M confronts C at the end and he takes his gun out of the thing? That was originally Bond confronting him, and it was a nod back to the Casino Royale, I know where you keep your gun sort of thing.
I like that.
Do just say, leave you to think that C stands for something other than, what does M say it is?
Careless.
Careless, yeah. So that was fascinating to me. And also, we have new products in podswag.com/bond. The Knickknack Tabasco shirt is officially for sale, as well as a replenishment of signed posters, and the Pigeon Double Taken Canango Balloon t-shirts are there as well.
Vote with your shirt monies, everybody.
Just, yeah.
So Pigeon Double Take should probably sell a lot more than
Doesn't
Canango
seem to
Balloon.
Be the case, though. And also, there's a Facebook group, I believe, now that a lovely listener has started. I think, I forget what it's called, but it's just James Bonding Facebook group, if you look it up. I don't know. I'm off Facebook again for a while. I can't take it.
Understood.
Yeah.
I can't take it either.
Yeah.
So I wanted to say that we saw the bagpipe machine gun in this movie.
Yeah.
And we're going to see it again next week.
Oh, that's
And the world
right.
is not enough.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it. They go to the Scottish castle.
Yeah.
Maurice, do you have anything to promote?
I've got a couple of things that I'd love to talk about, but I've got NDAs on them.
Wow.
Just one last observation. You talk about the recycling of the bagpipe gun. The poison pen letter joke appears in this movie first.
That's right. Yes,
in the Roger Moore film, the Roger Moore Bond people stealing from Charles K. Feldman.
And not only that, it's in this film, but they call out what a tired joke it
is.
What a tired joke it is.
It's
yeah.
I love that they also called out Orson Welles, Le Chiffre, for doing his magic again with, you know, the casino director going, oh, he's winning and doing magic tricks throughout. I love that. I just love those little
so
moments.
Funny to me.
I can talk about a Disenchantment coming up this summer from Matt Groening, and yours truly gets to play a rather Vincent Price-esque prime minister of the kingdom. But I'm very excited to be a part of that. Coming this Saturday, which means it will have passed by the time this is on the air, I've become part of the My Little Pony universe. I know that'll thrill your listeners.
It will.
But I am actually a villain. I'm a villain in My Little Pony.
Wow. So, yeah. What is your name?
I play Principal Headmaster Naysay. Yes, and we actually. Well, I can't go into too much, but so that's kind of fun, and I wish I could talk more about anything that I've been known for before that's coming back, but unfortunately I'm under an NDA
We'll have to have you back, and hopefully by then.
Well,
yeah, by
look,
then,
look really, I've read the rumors, guys. Stay tuned. There's going to be some great things coming.
Yeah.
Matt, we will meet again.
Oh, we're going to meet again. James Bonding will return.
For the world is enough.
No, huh? Not enough.
We did this movie.
No, man. Let's pick a new movie. You tried to convince me.
I think we did this.
Wait, should we pick another movie? Let's do Goldfinger again.
Oh, no, okay.
The world is not enough. Everyone's favorite James Bond
will return.
So you think Logan's a good person?
I do.
Came here because I was running.
Okay.
Running from myself.
Okay, please.
But I'm not going to run again.
I promise.
Maybe he's good then.
No, I'm one of the good guys.
Or maybe not.
Marvel and Stitcher present Wolverine the Long Night. Out now, only on Stitcher Premium. For 1 month free, go to WolverinePodcast.com and use promo code Marvel.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.
Hey, this is Arnie Niekamp from the improv fantasy podcast Hello from the Magic Tavern. I fell through a dimensional portal behind a Burger King in Chicago into the magical land of Foon, and I started a podcast. Season 3 has just begun with a brand new adventure to defeat the Dark Lord. If you're a new listener or you've fallen behind, Season 3 is a great jumping on point. And we've got great guests like Justin McElroy.
I sound like a fancy college professor. Eight nuts.
Rachel Bloom.
You all see my collection of men corpses and one woman.
Felicia Day and Colton Dunn.
You've seen me have intercourse with a variety of species.
It's a bummer.
Andy Daly.
You have the members of Genesis listed, but Phil Collins has crossed out and then circled and crossed out again.
Yes, I have killed Phil Collins twice.
Thomas Middleditch.
Jesus! I mean, Jazos! Ruler of the Eighth Circle!
And that's just the beginning. Season 3 of Hello from the Magic Tavern is out now. Listen in Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.